The following is a meeting with disciples with His Holiness Srila Satsarupa Das Goswami, given on August 9th, 1993, at Radadesh, Belgium.
So this is the day that the Supreme Lord appeared, tomorrow in this world. And so for many centuries, the time immemorial, it's been observed in India, but in the West only since Prabhupada. And he left India just before Janmashtami, a few days before Janmashtami in 1965. And he writes in his diary, "Observed Janmashtami at sea. I distributed khichdi to the crew. And maybe he had some discussions about Krishna. So it couldn't have been very much. All the captain, all the Indian seamen engaged in their duties with the ship. But Prabhupada noted it in his diary. So that was 65. And then he arrived in America in 3 months, or not 3 months. How long did it take him to get there? 30 days?
1 month.
1 month. So he arrived in America then, September 17. So then a year later, it was ISKCON had been formed, and Prabhupada had gone through so many difficulties. So it was like, and I remember, because I came before that, and so that Janmashtami was sort of like a climax of a first wave after a year uptown in Manhattan, and not having any much success, and then downtown in the Bowery, ending in being homeless. He got the new place, and then things started to happen. The devotees came, and so it built up just up to Janmashtami. Then the place was decorated. The devotees gave their belongings of curtains and pictures and decorated the room, and we made a dais for Prabhupada to sit on. And he had the first initiation. So Janmashtami was a kind of celebration of Prabhupada getting a foothold in America, the first Janmashtami. And because of that foothold, now we're able to have Janmashtami every year. We sort of take it for granted now. But Prabhupada wasn't taking it for granted. He was thinking, maybe I should go back to India. It's not working. And we go see the man of Sindhya steam lines. When is the next boat going back to India? And he would say, such and such. Prabhupada had a free pass. He could go back free. But then the date would come and he wouldn't go. And then he would go in again to the man. He says, when is the next boat going? He says, Swamiji, you keep asking, but you never take the boat back. He said, well, I'll just stay a little longer. I'll try. Let me try. But after that Janmashtami, he was determined to stay, and he initiated devotees, 12 devotees. So it's long ago to try to remember, but there's some things that I've remembered them and re-remembered them enough that they're in my mind. That he did propose to us, we would go for morning classes. So he proposed to us that on this day, rather than leave the temple, we would stay in the temple all day. Usually the devotees, they would just come like people go to a club. Like you go from your home and you go to attend something at some hall and then it's over and you go home. And in many cases, you don't have anything to do with that. It's some interest of yours. And then you go again when the meeting is held and you go home. It was like that. No, it was just Swamiji and after a while, one or two people who would help him out. So the idea that instead of just having a meeting and going out and doing our thing, that we should stay in the temple all day, that was a great demand or great sacrifice he was asking on our part. And the temple, this room is bigger than the temple was, so it meant staying cooped up in that little room on 26th Second Avenue all day with nothing to do. And So he said one thing he would do, if we liked, that he would read to us during the day from his manuscript of Bhagavad Gita as it is. It wasn't a book yet, but he was working on the manuscript. So he said he would come down and read to us. That was nice. Although it was hard to hear and understand so much philosophy, on the other hand. So mostly, he was up in his apartment, and we were just in the downstairs by ourselves. And the only thing I can remember doing was chanting. That's what he said to do. You should spend the day, we'll fast. But if you get too tired from fasting, you can come up and to my apartment, and you can take some fruits from the refrigerator. But only eat lightly today. If you have to eat, just take some fruits. And then in the evening we'll have initiation, and then we'll have a feast. So he was engaged in his apartment in cooking, but most of us were just down in the storefront. And there wasn't like so many friendships developed so deeply or with so much experience, and everyone was a little awkward with the philosophy still. All we knew was our faith in Swamiji. So it was very difficult. I remember passing the hours, and mostly what we did was chant. And these beads, everyone had the same beads made by the Tandy Corporation in America. They're the people who operate, I think they connect with Radio Shack. Sometimes you see a two-story building that have a Radio Shack and then a Tandy. Tandy sells leather craft and beads. And so they had a store on 14th Street in Manhattan. So that's where we got these beads. There's no question of Tulsi beads. At least they were wood, or in something horrible, objectionable material. Somebody saw my beads some time ago and he said, "Oh, you have painted your beads?" I said, "No, they came that way. They were red beads." And it's important that Vaishnavas chant on Tulsi beads. So I sometimes feel a little shy to show anybody, especially in India, that I'm not chanting on Tulsi beads. What's the matter with this person? This sannyasi, he should know better. He's got some red-colored beads. But usually I explain, I say, well, these are the beads that my spiritual master Prabhupada gave me in 1966. There were no Tulsi beads there. So I know these aren't, it's not sacred, but I consider it sacred. Oh, yes, then they usually can understand. But I have been, but in recent years I have been also yearning to touch the sacred Tulsi when I chant. So I have a second set of beads. And I try to divide my chanting. If I chant 16 rounds, I chant first 8 on those, and then I chant on Tulsi beads too. Not to neglect those, but not to deny myself the Tulsi. So we got these beads. Everyone was just sitting in the different corners of this little storefront chanting hour by hour, wrestling with the mind. But on his order, trying to spend the day like he said. So I remember to me it seemed like it was I was going to do it, but it was like a really severe thing. I felt like I was like fasting 40 days and I was a great saint. fasting and chanting, and I wasn't going to leave the storefront because he said don't leave, but it was so difficult, and yet we were doing it. And Prabhupada came down. He was very jolly to be able to read to us Bhagavad Gita. And he read for a while, or maybe for an hour. And then he reaffirmed that he would like us to stay there. And that's that one girl She became the wife of Mukunda. Janaki, her name was. And she said that, I can't stay, Swamiji, I have to go home. No, he said, you should, everyone should stay. He said, no, I have to feed my cats. He said, just today you can stay. She said, no, I'm sorry, I have to go. So with, like that, people made different excuses and left. As the afternoon wore on, there were fewer devotees left. It becomes a little hazy to me, all the details. But those are some of the memories of the first Janmashtami. And there was no first Vyas Pooj. Prabhupada didn't say a word that the next day was his birthday. Or if he did, it didn't penetrate our thick skulls that anything should be done about it. But then 1967, he was in India. By that time, he had come back. He had gone to San Francisco the year, came back to New York, gotten ill, gone to India, so he was in India, and there was no mention. There were letters back and forth, but he didn't say from India, now it's my birthday and you can do this and that. No mention. But then, by the next year, devotees found a Vyas Pooj book of Tubhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and they asked Prabhupada, what is this? And he said, it's customary on the day of the birthday of the spiritual master, disciples, they write some homages and they put it together in a book. So then the devotees really got enthused, and 1968 was actually the year that they put out the first book, and with a real flurry of activity, because there was no facility like desktop publishing in those days, but with a great effort they got together homages from the different devotees and produced the 1968 Vyas Pooj book. So there are a few of those here and there, you can find some. And then after that, gradually Prabhupada began to instruct the devotees and held them responsible for knowing how to observe it. And Janmashtami, that it was such a natural thing, the devotees saw that they could invite their congregations as temples started. Sometimes magically, in small storefronts where not many people were coming during the week and there didn't seem to be many Indians around for Sundays, on a midnight of Janmashtami, people would come to the temple. I remember a Janmashtami in the first storefront in Boston, like that. How happy we were to be able to serve some guests who came. So this wonderful combination, this is an ISKCON phenomenon that doesn't exist anywhere else, that we observe these 2 days together. So I saw that one offering, I was talking about the first Janmashtami at 26 Second Avenue, and one offering in this year's Vyas Pooj book. Of course, the fact that the book is offered to Prabhupada, does that mean it shouldn't be looked at beforehand? I think that's a formality in a sense. I'm sure people are looking at it here and there around the world. no harm. I just look at it. I mean, I was already looking at it in the van. So if I'm looking at it with you, it's no worse. I read one by Krishnakshetra Swami, Krishnakshetra, yeah, Maharaj, and it referred to, he made some interesting metaphor about 26 Second Avenue. If I can find it. Yeah, I'm in that section. Krishnadas Swami. Lokanath Swami. He's not a sannyasi. So then, Heidelberg. I think he wrote it for Heidelberg. Heidelberg, yeah. I just glanced at it, see if it's... He compares 26 Second Avenue, he makes a metaphor how the movement began in one place and spread to the preaching center, that each person is like a preaching center, and he starts with a crude beginnings and tries to then spread throughout his whole being, his whole consciousness. I think that for all of us who are now trying to follow in your footsteps, disciples, grand disciples, and friends, your first, quote, temple, unquote, in America at 26 Second Avenue in New York City holds special significance. At least for me, this modest storefront is a symbol of your personal victory, a symbol of your undaunted commitment to the order of your spiritual master. We had a nice time recently in Innisfraith, Ireland, with myself and my disciples. One evening we got together and we watched two videos of that place, the one that was on CBS television in New York called Happiness on Second Avenue, which is like all just Krishna conscious footage without any comments by them. And then another one, an amateur film called Matchless Gifts, and there's many nice shots of that temple in that time. At least for me, this modest storefront is a symbol of your personal victory. It is a symbol of the victory of the Krishna consciousness movement over the unmatched odds of Kali Yuga materialism. I never saw you personally at 26 Second Avenue, but I like to think of it as your permanent place of residence, a place of pilgrimage from where your mercy expands into my heart. Indeed, over the years, trying to serve you and become Krishna conscious, I have come to feel your presence in that particular scene. My heart, a New York City, a concrete and plastic jungle, a vast morass of doubts, delusions, and depressions, contains a relief agency at 26 Second Avenue, your preaching center, where you are seated, patiently offering me the matchless gifts of your sublime association. I can come at any time into your storefront where I can find you, the real matchless gift, Krishna's matchless gift of mercy. You are always there. From you, from your preaching center of matchless gift in my heart, I gradually gain confidence in the process of devotional service. I will, by your mercy, one day overcome the modes of material nature. I will, by your mercy, one day know what it means to take full shelter of Krishna. As from a nondescript storefront on 26 Second Avenue in New York, you launched the Krishna consciousness movement, which continues to spread like concentric waves throughout the world, so also from the 26 Second Avenue of my heart, you are spreading faith in Krishna to the farthest reaches of my being. One point about the preaching of 26 Second Avenue. Devotees weren't so aggressive as they are today in preaching because they just didn't have that inspiration, and Prabhupada wasn't demanding that much. He was pleased with anything we did. Like book distribution, there weren't any books to distribute. But we sold books from the storefront, and we produced the magazine, and then that magazine we distributed only in the local Manhattan area, to the stores, and sometimes on the street. So that reminds me somehow that it was a beginning center in that way too, that Prabhupada only gradually gave us the idea that this wasn't the only center, and that he also would go to start other centers, and that we should go to start other centers. And when we first heard that, we were certainly afraid that he was going to go, and we were all timid that we would have to go. So he even introduced, like informally in his room, that yes, we will go and we will open centers. He said, "So Brahmananda, where will you go? Russia?" And everybody laughed. And Agamuni, you will go to China? Everybody laughed. Because nobody thought anybody was going anywhere. Like that one devotee, his memoir, he says, I thought this was it, that it would stay eternally on the Lower East Side. But he put out those little waves that there would be something else. I remember there was a rumor at some point, somebody came and said he was going to donate some land in Alaska. Not a very likely place. But I think even today there's no center in Alaska. But right away there was some idea. Somebody's going to donate land. The devotees were talking about it. And to me it sounded so far-fetched. I was skeptical about it. I remember I had some words with Prabhupada about it. And he kind of shared or mimicked my skepticism, but he wasn't skeptical that such things could be done. Because he saw how Krishna took care of him, and it could be done all over the world. So in that sense also, 26 Second Avenue was a beginning, because the concept of preaching was only beginning. So he says, someday I will take shelter in that 26 Second Avenue, where we're just like babies, and all we have to do is just, if you can follow the four rules, if you can chant 16 rounds, you're doing fine. And just come to the classes and hear the Swami. And then, if you want to be really bold, you could wear your beads on the street. So he showed us about the beads, that you chant on these beads, and then when you're not chanting on them, you can keep them in a bag, a bead bag, or you can wear them around your neck. He said, if you're not ashamed. So that idea was there, that you might be ashamed to, because we didn't wear dhotis or have shaved heads. But this, so this was like the only marking that you were a follower of the Swami and Krishna consciousness. And it became a very, very much a thing that devotees did wear as like their single marking, especially in San Francisco. The devotees, it became like a style. The devotees would wear their beads around their necks like that. Otherwise, they had beards, long hair, and the girls just dressed like everybody else. But the Hare Krishna people in San Francisco, they had these beads. And they always wore them, and then they're right convenient for chanting. You see some pictures of Mukunda and others with their beads on. But he said it was actually proper to be kept in a nice bag. So if you could do those things, then that was plenty. And Prabhupada said later, people would say, do you have to shave your head to be a devotee? No, he said, I never told these boys, you can ask them. Some of these are old students. I never said that you should shave your head or wear these clothes. And it's true, he didn't. But one by one, the devotees wanted to do it. And when we did anything like that, he liked it very much. I remember when I shaved my head, and then I shortly afterwards I went up into his room and he saw me and he smiled and he said, "Thank you very much." So it was something that we knew would please him, but he didn't ask for it. Same with the tilak or the shaved head. But gradually, everyone wanted to do it until it became more or less required. It is required. And we're not ashamed. So he says, from the nondescript storefront, which continues to spread around the world, so you're spreading from my heart faith in Krishna to the farthest reaches of my being. Eventually there will remain no space left for anything but your mercy. At that time I may follow in your footsteps and challenge other conditioned souls with full confidence. What is the difficulty to always remain engaged in Krishna's service? Please therefore always stay with us in the preaching centers of our hearts and continue forever to preach to us and show us how to preach Krishna's glories to others on your behalf. So, any questions or discussions about observing Janmashtami and Vyas Pooj? Yeah.
Srila Prabhupada himself must actually be surprised about the results of his own preaching. Like in the beginning he didn't expect.
Yeah. Yeah, there's written statements by him about that. That we were surprised beyond our expectations.
And did you ever expect the devotees to shave their heads and walk on ropes?
No, he didn't. He later in his later writings, he expresses more confidence how everything is arranged by Krishna. Whatever he needs is being arranged, and whatever the devotee needs, Krishna will arrange. But as far as it the way it happened, and as he saw it, he said it was beyond his expectations. No one can know the mind of the acharya. We just can pick up different traces and different statements. Sometimes he says, he has said that everything was there. He would have temples one day, but it was only time separating. But he also said that he didn't expect that he would have such a big movement. He said, "I thought when I came and when I told them, please follow these four rules, they will say, 'No, go away, go home.'" But he tried. Elliot Prabhupada didn't present himself like a prophet who, you know, knew everything that was going to happen in the future and predicted what was going to happen. But he lived for the moment, so to speak, and month by month, whether he would have enough rent and how big the movement would grow. He was like very much in touch with the actual limits of the situation, how much money there was, how few devotees there were. So it's hard to say exactly what he anticipated. Prabhupada preaches with confidence that the whole world could take to Krishna consciousness, and if it's practiced, it will solve all problems. At the same time, he seems aware, I just heard him make a statement today, that it's not for the mass of people. The mass of people cannot take to this. Anything good, he says, it cannot be a mass movement. So, he says both both kind of things, like that expectation that it could happen, but living in the reality of the present with how few people are actually there, and accounting for that by the people's ignorance, and yet not being disappointed by that. I think we have so much to learn from Prabhupada about that, that we are a very tiny movement, insignificant movement in the worldly sense. So he wasn't resentful of that. He wasn't like personally hurt by it. He didn't have an inferiority complex, like some prejudiced minorities do. And yet, he thought it was certainly an injustice that the Krishna consciousness movement wasn't respected in the world. It's a sign of Kali Yuga. But he just had such like a sweet temperament of serving Krishna in this way that he wasn't soured by this. And gratefully accepted the service of the few people who did come, relatively few people. But it became more and more enlivened as more came. Prabhupada was such a realistic person, always in touch with as he was manager of the whole movement, of all the nitty-gritty, and growing movement meant growing problems too. That he later said that in the beginning I was happier because I had no one but Krishna to depend on. Now I have so many disciples to depend on, who you can't really depend on. So it was more anxiety. But he was, as a soldier, he was happy and willing to do it. But so with growth meant so many problems also. Having to deal with divorces, hearing that in some community they're smoking marijuana, and this and that, so many problems all coming to him. Oh, and one person writing from London saying, we just had elections and I'm in charge of the temple. And someone else saying, no, that person is no good, I'm in charge of the temple. And then they both fly to India to see Prabhupada and quarreling, all these things coming from different parts of the world. So he had so many problems as the movement grew. But he took them on for Krishna. I was reading about Lord Balaram on his appearance day. It says, his activities are inconceivable and all we can do is just discuss his pastimes. You cannot really try to understand them or explain them. So Prabhupada is like that too. We can just collect the different things and mention them and appreciate them. But ultimately he's incomprehensible. So on what you're saying about growth, he also was like very proud, and he would even boast of the growth of the Krishna consciousness movement. I heard in one lecture, he was in India especially, he would do that. Take the transcendental boasting position and say, he said, there is no record of any such business in the world that within a few years, he said, this business started with 40 rupees and now we have 40 crores. He said, there's no instance of any business expanding like that. In every center, he said, we have dozens of cars. He said, even in India, of course, not, he said, but even in India, each center has 5 or 6 cars, he said. But in the Western countries in America, every center, dozens of cars. So these things he would sort of rub in to the Indians, because he wasn't possessed of any false ego or boasting, but he was. That's the kind of preaching that would mean something to them. They already know about Krishna. We know everything about Krishna. But then he said, what do you know? You're so eager to run after technology and money, but look what I'm doing. He wouldn't necessarily say like that, but that was like the message. Look what I'm doing. I've got all the money and the cars and followers, and all I did was preach. If you preach pure Krishna consciousness, you'll get everything. But here you're begging, and you're not getting anything, and you have a reputation of being a beggar nation because you've abandoned Krishna. So this is India's position. And he said, even when I was in Berkeley, California, at University of California, one Indian student came to me. These different things had happened. different preaching encounters and questions, Prabhupada, they would become like archetypes for Prabhupada, like classic examples. He would like keep them all in his mind and bring them out. But what at the time may have seemed just like a small occasion later became like a regular preaching story. So that story of the Indian student in Berkeley, that's been repeated so many times by Prabhupada. So this Indian student came and said, Swamiji, what do we have to do with Krishna? We want technology. And Prabhupada said to the boy or would say to his audience later, just see, he said, this is India. This is India has become so downfallen that you say, what is Krishna? We want technology. So Prabhupada's view of what would happen or how it happened and how it grew sort of changed. And I see Prabhupada as like everything for preaching Krishna's message. That's like the steady principle of everything. And he could use anything in the service of Krishna. So those things that he might use, they might change. But whatever, he might do something sometimes some way and sometimes another way. But whatever he could say or do to glorify Krishna and further Krishna consciousness movement, he would do that. That's why we shouldn't be bewildered by things that appear to be contradictory. They're all in the same principle of trying to convince people to take to Krishna consciousness. Or to explain what the absolute nature of Krishna consciousness, whether it's saying how many people can't take to Krishna consciousness or many people will take to Krishna consciousness, they're all just parts of the same Siddhanta. And analogies, they're just all in the service of the absolute. Anyone else? Yeah. Janmashtami Day, yeah. He read, that particular occasion, he read from the manuscript, so he had typed pages, and just page after page he was reading what we now have as Bhagavad Gita. I don't remember what section it was. So he was reading the pages of our now Bhagavad Gita as it is. No, he didn't say that Krishna was born in Mathura and on this day. At least I don't remember. Maybe he did, I don't remember. But not when he read the Bhagavad Gita, he didn't. Hayagriva, in his book, he talks about the lecture that Prabhupada gave that evening in that book, The Hare Krishna Explosion. I don't think, there may have been something about Krishna's pastimes there that in the evening, if you look in that book. But to my memory, Krishna's pastimes means the Krishna book, and that was 1969. And as they started coming over the dictation tapes and into the manuscripts, and then finally the book, at least that was when the whole society knew about Krishna. And that was the first time we started with great delight telling about Krishna. And I was a typist of the manuscript, so I would hear the stories first, and then I would give a lecture. Every time I would give a lecture, I would tell stories that nobody ever heard before. I was in great demand for a while, and after a while, the book came out, and everybody else knew them too. But I would say, and then Krishna took the butter and he gave it to the monkeys. Wow, really? And what else did he do? What else did he do? That was the pastime. The Krishna book. Wonderful time. The Krishna book coming out and the paintings being done. Mm-hmm. Prabhupada had this, he wanted a painting done every day, one painting a day he wanted. And they couldn't do it, but they used to try to do it. And there was they had a whole team of painters and they would paint, and then the printing, this is in Boston, when we had when the Krishna book was coming out, we produced it in Boston, and they would paint, and then the paint, I was supposedly the art, in charge of the art department, but then the printer, he would be the one who would take the paintings at a certain time, and they would photograph them. They did in the temple, and then the painting was finished. So the thing would be that they would demand, the painters would demand, we're not finished this painting yet. And say, well, you've only got such and such hours, you have to have all these paintings photographed. And then they would almost be like a fight. Then they would, the printing department would come up, or they would wait till the artist went to sleep and then take the painting. You can even see in the Krishna book, one painting in particular, it's where, only in the first edition, that these crude paintings are not there anymore, but the old Krishna books. There's a picture where Krishna is speaking to Rukmini that you shouldn't be married to me, and she faints. That painting is like, it's maybe two-thirds finished. It's not finished. And it's photographed, and it's in the book. You can see there's like pillars that aren't painted, and Rukmini's half painted. And that was just, the printing department just got fed up with all the delays and took the picture and photographed it. Because Prabhupada said, I want a painting done every day. And He gave projection for all of us. He said, I've been thinking like this, that if I could dictate, if I dictate and then you can type and edit and such, and if you can get it back to me in this way, we can do a book, I can give you a book every 2 months. So he gave us these things that would, that was before the famous 17 books in 2 months. But it's exciting to live like that with a whole community of devotees dedicated to doing something directly for Prabhupada to produce his books. Wonderful energy. And then when the devotees admitted they couldn't do it, it was too much, he said, it was just my idea, he said. I don't mean you have to do a painting every day. If it takes you longer, then you take whatever it takes. So your question was about Janmashtami and Krishna's pastimes. That only came gradually, I think. I also remember, though, that before, I remember going to Boston and being there, and there weren't so many Indians coming to our little storefront. It was in a low-class student area near Boston University. But I remember one Indian man came, and he was typical, I know Krishna. And he started telling pastimes of Krishna. And I got so agitated. I didn't know the pastimes, but I didn't want to hear them from this person. We were a little fanatical about non-devotees and devotees, and I thought that I might instantly get poisoned or lose my Krishna consciousness if I heard this man telling Krishna stories. And because he was an authorized person, he wasn't a devotee. And I don't know what I did, really. I just ran away from him or told him to stop or something, but so it was a great relief when we finally knew something about Krishna from Prabhupada. Then we could know what other people were saying or tell them what Krishna did. And Prabhupada wasn't stingy about the pastime, telling us the pastimes of Krishna. He would from time to time. Krishna and the other incarnations also, Prahlad and Sringadev, Bali Maharaj, everything came in his talks and so on. Lord Chaitanya.